NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Savannah, Georgia's mayor is warning people to stay home. Atlanta's emergency rooms are filling with hypothermia patients. Part of I-10 outside Tallahassee, Florida was closed down today because of a rare snowfall. North Carolina is in a state of emergency through Friday because of the cold. And there is a storm hitting the whole East Coast today and tonight. Let's bring back meteorologist David Epstein. David, you say New England will experience bombogenesis.
Yes, it's a term, it's a meteorological term that explains a storm that rapidly intensifies. So if a storm intensifies 1 millibar per hour over the course of a day, basically getting stronger, that's a meteorological way to say it. Rapid intensification is another way to say it. So we're going to experience the effects of a storm which is rapidly intensifying across New England. And that same storm, as you mentioned, is bringing snow and ice all the way from the panhandle of Florida up to Maine. It's amazing. I see winter storm watches and warnings from Florida to Maine. You don't see that very much.
No. And just before we leave my favorite word, bombogenesis, somebody said it sounds biblical, you know, because Genesis is in there. But it's also called a bomb cyclone, bomb hurricane.
Bombogenesis is, again, just a term that explains rapid intensification. So a hurricane could undergo bombogenesis. A nor'easter can undergo bombogenesis. It's an adjective to describe the way a storm's going to intensify.
Okay, we'll be looking for that. But in Florida, Disney World has already closed some of its water attractions. How cold do you think it might get in Florida?
Yeah, I was looking at the wind chill advisories, which go almost down the entire panhandle, which is pretty amazing. And even in West Palm Beach for tomorrow morning, when folks get up there, the wind chills will be right around that 30-degree mark. That's pretty cold for places that don't experience that kind of chill. And around Disney World tomorrow morning, it'll be about freezing temperatures during the day. Thursday, they're only getting into the 50s. And the same thing on Friday, Saturday. Finally, on Sunday, they'll start to near 70. So it's 3 days of really cold weather, the type of weather you're not going to want to be swimming in that part of the country.
Right, right. Well, and talk about the Midwest as well, because they're really having this cold snap as well. What are you seeing there?
Well, the upper Midwest continues to be very cold. Places in International Falls, Minnesota, of course, we saw some records over the past week. Temperatures there today are below zero. They're not going to get above zero until sometime on Friday in parts of the upper Midwest, and those temperatures continue. I do see a nationwide thaw eventually coming for the second half of January. It'll overspread the entire country at that point. So we are looking for a break from winter, but you're going to have to hold on another 10 to 15 days.
Well, meanwhile, with this storm coming up the coast, obviously there's going to be crops further south that people will be worried about, and electricity. I with the heavy snow that many parts are getting, followed by, someone said, and then it's really going to get cold, as if it hasn't been cold, starting Friday, I understand, another cold snap. What can we be worried about? I mean, electricity, I'm thinking.
Yeah, so parts of the Northeast will experience this snowstorm. And if that were the only thing we were getting, it would be a typical wintertime snowstorm. It's not unusual in that sense. But the winds with the storm combined with power outages, then you add in very cold weather, temperatures not reaching 10 over most of New England for the daytime on Friday and Saturday, especially. That's when it's the core of the cold. If you lose your power, it won't take long for the pipes to get cold enough for the water in them to freeze. And then when it does warm up, the pipes actually start bursting. The cold in itself, if you don't have power, that can be problematic and downright dangerous for folks with temperatures below zero here Saturday night.
It is biblical. Meteorologist David Epstein, it's winter. Thank you for talking about the upcoming bombogenesis effect. Is that, did I use it correctly as an adjective?
The upcoming bombogenesis low pressure system.
Thank you. Thanks
You're
so
welcome.
Much.
There's a scramble on to replace the longest serving Republican member of the United States Senate, one day after Senator Orrin Hatch made this announcement.
When the president visited Utah last month, he said I was a fighter. I've always been a fighter. I was an amateur boxer in my youth, and I brought that fighting spirit with me to Washington. But every good fighter knows when to hang up the gloves. And for me, that time is soon approaching.
Well, polls seem to be showing that Hatch's popularity is fading in Utah, and now there's speculation about who might replace one of the president's most vocal supporters. Lisa Riley Roche covers politics for the Deseret News, and she joins us from Salt Lake City. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, in that bit of tape that we played from the senator's announcement yesterday, he mentioned the president's trip to Utah last month. And of course, President Donald Trump had encouraged Orrin Hatch to run again. I mean, why is Orrin Hatch not doing that? Why has he decided to retire?
Listen, I think this was a very, very, very tough decision for Senator Hatch. He has been in the Senate. It'll be 42 years when his term ends at the end of the year. And he is 83 years old. What might make it a little easier for him, however, is the candidate that he's clearly indicated he'd like to see succeed him. Mitt Romney, the 2012 Republican nominee, who's been calling Utah home for a while now and is very popular here, by all appearances, is going to step into the race.
But that's interesting, though, right? Because Romney has been very critical of President Trump, whereas, you know, in the past year, Orrin Hatch has been very supportive. I mean, he even called the president the greatest president he's ever had the privilege of serving under. So help us understand sort of that dichotomy there.
Sure. You got to remember, Hatch hasn't stayed in the Senate and hasn't built the influence he has because he isn't a good politician. He's very good. And he knows that here in Utah, even though we're one of the most reliably Republican states in the country, Donald Trump is just not that popular. He wasn't popular as a candidate. He came in third place in the Republican caucus vote. And in November, when it came down to a choice between the Democrat Hillary Clinton, the Republican Donald Trump, and then we also had an independent candidate, Evan McMullen, a conservative, voters went for Trump, but in small numbers. He got about 45% of the vote here. And he has just never caught on. His style, some of the crude things he has said, don't appeal to a place like Utah, where we value morality, we value decency, we value civility. So Senator Hatch realizes that. And someone like Mitt Romney, who has just been enormously popular over the years, Romney spoke for a lot of Utahns when he criticized Trump during the 2016 Republican primary race,
yeah,
calling him a fraud and a phony.
Lisa, can I just jump in here for a second? Because everything that you said about Utah voters makes a lot of sense to me. But then how does that explain Senator Hatch's fealty to President Trump? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, did that relationship, is that one of the things that dragged down Senator Hatch's popularity at home in Utah?
I think Utahns were probably more concerned about the length of time Senator Hatch had been in office. You've got to remember, long before Trump came on the scene as a candidate, Senator Hatch was challenged in 2012 by a Republican and faced his first primary since his initial election in 1976.
I see.
This is also the state where a longstanding Republican Senator Bob Bennett was ousted by Republican delegates at a state party convention in 2010, one of the first big moves by the Tea Party effort nationwide. Hatch has been seen as close to Trump, and that might disturb some Utah voters, of course. But Hatch has also used that relationship to deliver for Utah voters. And by deliver, I mean things like the reduction of the national monuments here in Utah, the Bear's Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante national monuments that the president came out at Senator Hatch's invitation to announce reductions to. And on that same trip, Senator Hatch was able to arrange for the president to meet with leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that probably offered some assurances to Utah voters that had their doubts about Trump.
But let me ask you, he's had a 40-year-long career in the Senate. Many people look at his career and remember Senator Hatch for actually a long stretch of bipartisanship. And I want to actually play a clip here from a recent Senate hearing just back in November, which we found quite telling. And this is when Senator Hatch and Democrat Sherrod Brown got into a shouting match, actually, over the proposed tax reform bill. Brown had been accusing Hatch of catering to the rich. And here's what happened.
I come from the lower middle class originally. We didn't have anything. So don't spew that stuff on me. I get a little tired of that crap. And let me just say something. If we work together, we could pull this country out of every mess it's in. And we could do a lot of the things that you're talking about, too. And I think I've got a reputation of having worked together with Democrats.
Let's start with Chip.
Not starting with CHIP. I did it. I've done it for years. I've got more bills.
Start with CHIP today.
I got more bills passed than everybody on this committee put together.
Now, they were referring to CHIP in that exchange. That's the Children's Health Insurance Program, which Senator Hatch also recently said there was no money for, so it's not funded right now. So, I mean, Lisa, walk us through, you know, a little bit about how people are looking upon Senator Hatch's career.
Well, that clip shows Hatch the fighter. He's the kind of guy that does what he needs to do to get done what he thinks needs to get done for the state. And sometimes that means talking tough to keep the Republicans together on an issue and get something through, as we saw with the tax package that just passed. He's been more than able to do that throughout his career.
Well, Lisa Riley Roche covers politics for the Deseret News. She's speaking to us today from Salt Lake City. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In Chicago, in neighborhoods where illegal guns are commonplace, the resulting epidemic of gun violence has authorities on the hunt for gun dealers. Reporter Mick Dumke wanted to learn more about how that hunt works, so he dug into the case of one man arrested for moving some of those illegal weapons. Dumke's story is produced by WBEZ, ProPublica Illinois, and the Chicago Sun-Times as part of the WBEZ series Every Other Hour.
If the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives wanted to catch a big-time player in Chicago's gun trafficking, John Thomas was not their guy. Prior to this, he says he hadn't sold a single firearm. So how then, back in 2014, did he get caught up in an ATF sting? To understand that, you have to know a little about John. He grew up in an area of Chicago known for its history of violence, Terror Town.
Surviving over in the area I grew up, you had to be a hardball or stay to yourself type person, because if you didn't, you would fall in the streets or you would end up 6 feet deep.
It's where John had family and friends, some of whom were homeowners and churchgoers. Others were caught up in drugs and gangs. John went back and forth between these worlds. John's a charmer and a small-time hustler. He has a rap sheet filled mostly with low-level, nonviolent offenses. But by late 2013, John says he wanted to go straight. He was 29, raising a 2-year-old daughter. He was looking for legit, legal work. But with a criminal record, there weren't a lot of options. John finally caught a break, though, and landed a job at a tobacco shop not far from Terror Town. But the pay was low, $25 a day.
I said, $25 a day? I said, I can't survive out that. I got a whole child and rent more. I said, I'll take it. What else could I do? I'll take it.
Right away, John starts making new connections.
At work one day, this guy, he come in there with a ponytail, I'll never forget. His name, Yusuf. He talking about some girls and hot weed and stuff.
By early 2014, John and Yusuf are hanging out, smoking weed and joking around together. Yusuf gets to know more about John, how little he makes, that he has friends back in Terror Town, that John has a daughter.
Weeks and weeks go down. He come to me, hey, bro, you want to make some masati, bro, some real money? I'm like, what you mean? He like, man, this $25, bro. He like, I got somebody right now, but you can make some real money off of. I say, wow, what you got to do? Bro, you got some guns? I say, boy, where we from? We don't sell guns.
But Yusuf keeps coming around, pestering John about guns. John keeps telling him no.
One day he coming up with a whole lot of money. I say, damn, bro, where you get that from? He like, bro, I told you, bro, Pop's hooking me up, bro. So who the f*** is Pops?
Yusuf tells John that Pops is a businessman he's working with to buy guns.
He said, you straight? You need something? I'm like, hell yeah, I need something. You know, he peeled me off a $100 bill or whatever. So I'm like, damn, I needed this.
Yusuf tells John that he can get good money now if he helps them, and that Pops might be able to hook him up with something legit later. By late January 2014, John's financial outlook is still bleak, and the money Yusuf keeps offering him to set up gun buys, $100 for handguns, $150 for long guns, is too enticing, too easy. John bends. He makes a call.
At the time, I was thinking, like, how much trouble can I get just for a phone call, just hooking somebody up? So I call my cousin. His name's Steve. first thing when I asked him for a gun, first he, man, who you into it with? You all right? I said, nah, I'm cool. I'm like, man, they paying good money for a gun, man. He, you sure you know him? I'm like, yeah, he cool. He be up here with us. He said, all right. So he come up there. They went in the back. They handled their business. Yusuf came out. He gave me some money. I'm like, dang, I just made 200 quick bucks. Not doing nothing? Cool. All right.
And just like that, John brokers his first gun deal. There would be nearly two dozen more. What John doesn't know is that Yusuf turns around and sells these guns for a profit. And what neither of them knows is that the people buying them are working for the government, including Pops. The ATF busts Yusuf. He agrees to work undercover as a confidential informant. The ATF wouldn't talk with us for this story. But John says, and court records confirm, that he and Yusuf are in regular contact in the months that follow, and many of their meetings and phone calls are secretly recorded. John likes the money, a lot, but he still wants legit work from Pops. He confronts Yusuf about it.
So I'm like, man, what's up, man? I need a job, you feel me? He said, Pops gonna hook you up.
Pops is not going to hook John up. In April of 2014, John helps arrange four deals involving a dozen guns. In May, it's seven transactions for 11 more. At some point, John says his conscience started to get to him.
I remember one day I said, Yusuf, what are you doing with all these guns, for real? If you get them off the street, I will help you. I'm like, because I'm against guns. You know, I got a daughter. He like, man, trust me, Batman, we get them off the street. I said, all right, cool. The more off the street, the better.
Did you believe that? I mean, what did they mean by taking it off the street?
He told me that they were melting them down at a factory.
Did that seem believable to you? I mean, you're a pretty smart guy. You've seen...
Yeah, honestly, because the money that the Pops was having, that was really tricked me.
Yeah, what kind of car you in?
It's May, and still pretty cool out, mid-40s.
You said you don't want my people what?
John is out with Yusuf. They're heading just outside the city to meet up with a guy for the first time. He's known as BD. His real name is Trayson Watson. Yusuf is wearing a wire.
We ain't worried about none. Joey.
BD is pushing a semi-automatic rifle that looks like an AK-47 and a handgun reconfigured to fire like a machine gun.
That bitch A1, bro. Hold this bitch like New Jack City on stone.
Not everyone Yusuf buys from thinks the guns are being melted down. He tells some people he's sending the guns overseas. That's what he tells BD.
I told you my business is overseas. I don't f*** around in here. I don't go f***. Got 10 murders on it. I don't go f***. Count your love, bro.
By June, John has brokered the sale of more than two dozen guns. And then he calls Larry.
I met Larry McIntosh, which is 10, through a person I used to sell drugs from.
10 has access to a lot of weapons. Over the next 3 months, John brokers deals between 10 and Yusuf involving more than 40 guns, from little pistols to semi-automatic rifles. John, 10, Pops, and Yusuf arrange their biggest deal yet. It's set for Tuesday, August 26th, 2014.
I knew it should have been scary, though, you know, because I'm looking like, oh my f***ing God, they buying 17 guns at a time.
Then, early Tuesday morning, John gets a phone call.
Yusuf called me that morning. He was like, plans has changed. We got to meet Pops. We got to sit down. So I get dressed. I call my peoples. He came and picked me up. He took too long. So as I walk outside the gate, I see a white lady in a PT car. I'm like, what the hell she doing in Englewood on 51st Street in the wee hours of the morning? So I throw a left. I see some more white people in a van. I say, oh, yeah, this don't look right. So I turn around. I'm finna walk back in my building. My peoples pull up. I say, damn. I was finna call him and tell him forget the whole thing. We going up 53rd. I said, man, see, something funny about this. He like, man, they own us. I say, who own us? So I see some crazy lights. These ain't regular police lights. I look up, it's a big old Suburban SUV in front of us. The guy getting out the car with the gun, he almost fell with it. It's so big. I'm like, dang. He grabbed me, throw me out. He, what's your name? I say, John. He like, John what? He say, Thomas. He like, yeah, that's you.
The ETF agents take John in.
We get there, and we end up talking to some nerdy guy with glasses.
This is in daytime. What happened today?
That nerdy guy is a special agent with the ATF.
This is daytime. What happened based on things that have happened over the last 7 months.
He was thinking he's slick.
You know where I'm going with this?
He acts like he doesn't know why he's been brought in.
Who is this? Don't act stupid.
On the table between them are several manila folders filled with pictures.
You don't know him?
They're still images, apparently pulled from the videos Yusef has been secretly recording for the ATF. There are pictures of John's cousin Steve, BD, and John. John looks confused.
You put all this together?
Then he suddenly realizes who set him up.
I'm like, Yusef. Yeah, Yusef. And I'm like, Dad, Yusef just called me 2 days ago, asked me was I okay, was my daughter cool, this. And he knew how I felt about it, and he knew I was weak. So at my weakest stage, he won. You know, he won. Honestly, he won because I needed the money, and he got me. He played me like a violin. He got me.
John wasn't the only one who got played by Yusef. In total, 14 men were brought in that day. Most, but not all, got involved through John. 77 guns sounds like a lot, even to John Thomas. He says he messed up. He knows he messed up bad. But he still doesn't think he's played any part in Chicago's gun violence epidemic. John says he was never part of any gun sales before he met Yusef. Government prosecutors haven't disagreed. John's defense attorney argues that if government informants hadn't pursued him, John might never have brokered a single firearm. All of which raises a difficult question. Do cases like John's, government stings that essentially target low-level hustlers, do they actually break up gun networks or create them?
We leave you with that question. In September 2017, John Thomas was sentenced to 7 years in federal prison. In October, he reported to a medium security facility in central Illinois. Yusef is set to be sentenced in March. This story was reported by ProPublica Illinois' Mick Dumke, produced by WBEZ's Joe Dassault, and edited by WBEZ's Kate Cahan. It's Here and Now.
Forty-three of the largest public universities in the United States do not track student suicides. That's according to recent findings from the Associated Press. And without that data, there's no way for schools to know if efforts to improve student mental health are actually having a positive effect on campus. Joining us now is the AP reporter behind this story, Colin Binkley. Colin, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So 43 of the largest public universities in the United States don't track suicide statistics at all? I mean, why?
Well, there are a lot of reasons why a school wouldn't necessarily track suicide data. The biggest and most obvious is that it's really, really difficult for universities to track this data. Everyone universally says that. It can be hard to determine the cause of death, even if they know that a student has passed. And beyond that, they're not always notified when a student dies. The medical examiner who does the autopsy isn't required to notify a university. Often families prefer to keep the cause of death private, so even schools that really try to do this can have a lot of difficulty finding out whether a student has taken their own life. The big thing that advocates say is that they at least need to be trying, because if you're not getting the data, you're not going to find out about important trends that could be used to help save lives.
Right. So the AP asked 100 of the largest public universities this question, and 46 of them told you that they do currently track suicide. So of those 46, have they seen some kind of benefit to trying to gather that data?
Absolutely. The data can be really invaluable. But they already know, for example, the research literature has shown that suicide rates are higher among, for example, LGBT students or, you know, LGBT people more generally. So by tracking the data, they can find out if there are particular trends. For example, have more than one student's taken their own lives from a particular dorm room or a dorm building or a particular campus organization. Some schools have been able to identify some trends and work to address them at Clemson University, which started tracking data a little more detailed in 2015. They noticed an increased suicide rate among transfer students, and now they're actually working to redouble their efforts to connect those students with campus resources and to teach them about mental health so that they know if they're having trouble, they can go get help on campus.
And finally, Colin, I'm curious, again, of those schools who have been able to track the data to the best of their ability, How does what they're finding compare to what we're seeing in terms of national trends in suicide amongst college-age young people?
Well, we got really pretty robust data from 27 universities, and those showed suicide data they had collected from 2007 through 16. And what they had seen, it varied quite a bit from school to school, but for those that had pretty strong data, it fell in line with what past research has shown is normal at colleges, and that's a suicide rate of about 6.5 to 7.5 per 100,000 college students. And that's already much lower than in the general population, which has been increasing and is around 13 per 100,000 right now. Because there is no data, for example, for all universities across the country, there's no way to know if that trend is reflected among all college students, but among those that had data, it remained actually pretty level over the decade, and there wasn't a whole lot of change, which some said was a sign of success, others said needs to be taken with a grain of salt because of some inconsistencies in the data.
Well, Colin Binkley is a reporter for the Associated Press. Colin, thank you so much.
Great, thank you.
And it's frigid in parts of the country. Maybe you're wiping your dog's feet of ice and salt after a walk. But when should you not take them for a walk? Dr. Kim Smythe is a staff veterinarian with Pet Plan Insurance and a pet health writer in Charlottesville, Virginia, who's drawn up a great color-coded chart to tell you when not to. It's got temperatures and pet size. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. Dr. Smythe, why'd you do this?
The common question we get as veterinarians is, how cold is too cold for my dog to go outside? And the answer is, there's no one right answer for every dog.
Well, you say, for instance, that if you've got a husky that's trained to do the Iditarod, they'll be okay in those freezing temperatures. But if you take a regular house husky and drop them up in the Arctic, they'll die.
That's right. You have to take into account acclimation to the weather, as well as the size of your dog and the breed of your dog and their overall health.
Okay, so you've got this chart, and basically it's going to be too cold for different sized dogs and dogs with different hair at certain times. But
right.
How do you know? I mean, does your dog tell you when they're too cold?
Right. Every dog is going to be different. And some dogs, even small dogs, like to stay outside. So you're going to have to kind of play by your dog's rules too. But know that under 30 degrees, factoring in the wind chill, it's not going to be safe for any dog to be outside for an extended period of time.
Even with sweaters and booties and things like that?
You can buy yourself a little bit of time with warm weather clothing. But at the end of the day, you want to take into account your dog's safety and your pet's best advocate.
And by the way, those booties that are supposed to protect dogs' pads from ice, but also from the de-icing agents, which they can't even walk on, which are horrible. How do you know when their pads are really in trouble?
For dogs that have a lot of pigment and the pads are black, you may not know until the skin sloughs off. For dogs who have light-colored pads, you could look for redness, swelling. Pain when they walk is especially telling.
Yeah. Some people are just, if they're smaller dogs, just carrying them in the winter now because
yes.
There's so much stuff out there. And you say if you see a dog that has hypothermia, if what, they're shivering and you know, their heartbeat is off?
Right. Shivering would be the first sign, and dogs with moderate to severe hypothermia won't even shiver. So you'll want to get these dogs inside, wrap them up in a warm towel or blanket, and get them to the vet if you need to.
Yeah, water bottles might help, but be careful with electric blankets.
Anything that is electric that you can plug in has the chance to get too hot and cause thermal burns.
And what about cats? Many people are moving to indoor cats to preserve the birds and to preserve the cats because so many are getting hit by cars or preyed upon by predators. But if your cat has to go out and hunt, what should you do for them?
Just make sure they have an insulated shelter outdoors and access to water that's not frozen. Cats are really good at hiding, finding nice warm hiding spots, including under the hood of your car. So in the morning when you go out, before you start your car, please bang on the hood, scare the cat out so they don't get trapped in the fan.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Kim Smythe, staff veterinarian with Pet Plan Insurance and a pet health writer in Charlottesville, Virginia. Dr. Smythe, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So let's stay with cats fire cats. One of our favorite articles this week was in the New York Times about Jennifer Petruska of Santa Rosa, California. After the October wildfire, she's devoted her life to finding the runaway cats, going out almost every night with volunteers. Jennifer Petruska joins us now by Skype from Santa Rosa. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. Or as I've been calling you, St. Jennifer. So we understand you've set up night vision cameras to find hiding spots. What are you doing?
You know, as we go along, we create a process for how we find these cats. So one of the things we do is we set up feeding stations, especially in my area, Coffee Park. And we put up 100 feeding stations right away, right after the fires. And we monitor those and refill them every single day. And when we start seeing somebody eating out of it, then we put in night cameras and start seeing who's coming. And due to the large number of pets that are missing, it's really hard to say, oh, that's that particular cat from that particular house when you have 30 brown tabbies missing and a dozen black-haired, short-haired cats. But once we get them on camera, then we set a trap plan in place. And a huge group of volunteers are out there every single night catching these cats.
Oh, man. Well, first of all, I'm sure the raccoon population in your area is thrilled to have these feeding stations. I mean, are you seeing on these night cameras other creatures as well?
Oh, absolutely. We got skunks and foxes, possums, even got a squirrel once.
Yeah. Well, but so the cats. Now, we're learning that dogs tend to run towards their owners when there's a crisis. Cats take off. Do you have a sense of how many took off?
Well, let's see. When we first started this, there were over 650 animals listed as missing from the fire. Of that 650 or so, we have caught 279.
Wow.
So roughly, and those are rough numbers because it changes daily.
And so your group, Pet Rescue and Reunification, as the volunteers are calling themselves, fan out every night to try to check on these feeding stations. What are you putting out for the cats?
Well, it's just dry kibble for the feeding stations. And once we go into a trap plan, we kind of mess around seeing what works best. And we use the canned mackerel, the canned tuna, and we hang a smelly, smelly wet sock soaked in mackerel juice above the trap to try to get that smell out there. And that's thanks to Kimberly Freeman, who does cat searches individually.
And you found that works. We know you got two cats just today. What are they like when you get them?
Usually, you know, trapping is not a pleasant experience. So every cat we catch goes into a dark, quiet room, and they just stay covered and stay quiet for a few hours. We don't attempt to microchip scan them or transfer them to a carrier, do anything until they've had some downtime.
Well, and we understand many are burned, their paws are singed, their whiskers are singed, they are, you know, don't weigh a lot. And what's that reuniting moment like?
Oh, you know, the hugs, the tears, the shock, it's all so overwhelming. I have people that want to rush down and get it, and then they're like, oh my gosh, I have no litter box, I have no carrier. And I'm like, take a deep breath. It'll be okay. The cat will spend the day with me until you can make it. And then lots and lots of tears and just a lot of gratitude. It's every reunion. It is so profound. You've got to realize that these people have lost every bit of their lives. Their homes, their whole histories have been destroyed. And it is the one piece that we can give back to them that might not have been lost.
We'll talk a little bit about that. In Coffee Park, where you are, 1,000 homes just gone, ash. Yeah. 5,000 homes destroyed in Santa Rosa alone. This is a pretty bleak, charred landscape you're working in.
It's awful. It's just little pieces of people's lives that you realize, and every piece mattered. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's huge.
Well, so we understand you're getting some of your funding through rescue leagues, other rescue leagues, which might collect some money for you to help you with some of the items that you need to do this. But other than that, there's really nothing in it for you. You're at 4 o'clock every day going out on these overnight trips. Why are you doing this?
You know, because this community needed me. I felt that I started out doing, you know, wanting to get tools donated and I wanted to get art donated. And I realized right away that pets was where my heart really lay. So that's where I turned my focus to.
And by the way, we're just talking about Santa Rosa, but this past year saw so many catastrophes. And we remember during Harvey, as the Times points out, in Houston, cats, you know, would be swimming in flooded water or floating by on furniture, trying to get to higher ground. I mean, this is something that's happened in other parts of the country as well. How long do you think you can do it?
Well, we'll do it as long as we keep catching fire cats. I could see at least going for another year and maybe two if we're still catching them.
Wow. And by the way, you say you do profiles of the cats to try to figure out what you see.
Yes.
So we understand you're carrying around things that cats might like. Like what?
Yeah, well, the whipped cream for Spot, because Spot always comes to the can of whipped cream going off. Kiwi, a kitty missing, only comes down to the sound of Kiwi. So you have to like call a certain way. So, and Petey likes bacon. So it's just little tricks. You get to learn about these animals you're looking for, and any tricks we can try, we are.
Oh, I wish you the best in finding Kiwi, Spot, and Petey. And the many other.
And many more.
Yeah. Jennifer Petruska of Santa Rosa, leading the effort to track down the fire cats, cats lost in the Northern California wildfires back in October. Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate it.
In California, the sharing economy is hot. Car rides, community gardens, and housing. Now, there's a tiny nonprofit in the San Francisco Bay Area that's using sharing to help ease one of the country's worst homelessness crises. The company's called SafeTime, and it works like Airbnb, but the rooms are free and the guests are homeless. Terrell Burt was one of the first to sign up. She's 65 and she lives alone in El Cerrito near Berkeley. And she recently invited a homeless family to live with her. Ariel Plotnick checked in on how it's going.
Nikki Creer and her 5-year-old son, Demarie, have just moved in to Terrell Burt's 3-bedroom townhouse. And they've already spotted a hawk. It flew down to the balcony and perched on a chair.
Yeah, he's back.
Wow.
Wow. He likes it. He came back to see you. He loves it here only because of the view, and he likes animals and nature.
SafeTime works by matching up hosts and guests for short stays, a month or two usually. The guests aren't necessarily living on the streets, but they are homeless. To qualify, they can't have a criminal history or drug issues. The day Creer moved in, Burt started a diary.
Today she arrives an hour early to move in. I am not ready. Inconsiderate or super responsible? Are we compatible? I look around and register that this is not a kid-friendly house. Too much glass and pottery. In walks a petite, outgoing young woman with a tall, handsome child. Mom, can I go on that swing? Come on, Mom. Excitement and joy floods the air.
Creer is 27, but still finding her way after years in foster care. She's a single mom with only a high school degree, so finding work has been tough. Burt watched homelessness explode across the Bay Area. Her friend, Chuck Grant, started SafeTime a few months ago. So far, the program has made 17 matches.
We thought there may be a significant number of people who would take folks into their homes for karma points.
Burt grew up in small town Illinois, and her parents would take in acquaintances who needed a place to stay. But even with that example, Burt needed something like SafeTime to make the arrangement feel more safe. Now it's up to her and Creer to figure out how to live together.
But we have to tell the truth.
Right.
If you get mad at me for something, you have to say.
Okay.
And if I get mad at you for something, I have to say. And then there comes not compromise.
Right, because it can't be perfect.
Cooperation.
Advocates who have worked with the homeless for a long time are watching this small experiment. Kelly Cutler works with the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco.
It's not just housing because, here's a room. Here, go in here. Is everything, like, perfect now? No. That's, you know, that you still need community.
A room helps, Cutler says. But people who are homeless also need services, jobs, healthcare, and sometimes childcare, too. Creer spent her summer working on all of that. She even went to Seattle to check out a job, but couldn't find anywhere to live. She and her son spent a lot of weekends in Sacramento, staying with relatives. She looked for apartments there, too.
How's the apartment hunt going?
It's excruciating to my brain. That's all I do from the time I wake up to the time I go to sleep. I'm looking for an apartment. That's all.
When Bert finally catches up with Creer, they've scarcely seen each other for weeks.
And so how long do you think you'll be here with Terrell?
I don't know. I was going to leave actually today.
Really?
That's a huge surprise to Bert. It's only been 1 month. That afternoon, out running errands, she's still feeling confused.
I don't know. I'm so her supporter in every way. I just feel like maybe she misrepresented her family situation. I mean, why are we here?
Bert had a lot of questions. If Creer was spending a lot of time in Sacramento with family, did she really need housing? And what exactly was she, a landlord or a friend? And the real frustration, why didn't Creer think things through? Sometimes her decisions just didn't make sense to Bert. Cutler with the Homeless Coalition says Bert's reaction is understandable.
If you're experiencing homelessness, you're in this constant crisis mode. And so it is a lot of reacting, and it's just about survival. Others who have stable housing and income would be like, I can't believe this decision that this person's making.
That night, after Bert got back from running errands, Creer began packing. A few days later, she and her son, Demarie, moved out. They eventually found an apartment they could afford in Sacramento, but she's still searching for a job. Since then, Bert has hosted 3 more people, and she's encouraged her friends to try it.
We can't solve homelessness overnight. We can only take baby steps to get there.
Bert doesn't have any guests right now, but she says she's ready to do it again soon. For Here and Now, I'm Arielle Plotnick.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.